Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin. Pop quiz. What do helicopters, hummingbirds, and a world record-breaking underwater press conference have in common? Well, if you haven't guessed, they're part of today's ongoing guest's incredible adventures. He's Eric Pittman. He's a former helicopter bush pilot, award-winning wildlife photographer, Guinness World Record holder, and a longtime conservationist. He's the creator of hummingbirdsupclose.com, where he shares stunning footage and research from over 15 years of documenting hummingbirds. National Geographic, BBC Wildlife Films, Netflix, CTV, BBC, and ITV have all featured his work. Eric's hummingbird footage is also at the heart of the My Bird in My Backyard, a documentary garnering over 1.7 million YouTube views and a 2025 Canadian Screen Awards nomination. If that's not already hit your wow factor, in the 1980s, Eric created Spectral Visions, a choreographed light show performed for Prince Charles and Princess Diana, and later contributed to Robert Plant's world tour. Robert Plant, of course, formerly of Led Zeppelin. Eric also founded a glass recycling foundry in Victoria. In 2006, he broke the Guinness World Record for the largest underwater press conference after learning to scuba dive to make it happen. Today, Eric works at Van Al Windows and co-leads the Canadian Orca Rescue Society, raising awareness with life-sized inflatable orcas and environmental events. He's been a Toastmaster for 6 years and a member of Thunderbird Toastmasters Club in Victoria. Eric was featured in From Helicopters to Hummingbirds, How One Toastmaster Used His Skills on Camera, Underwater and Beyond by Megan Preston Mayer in the August 2025 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Coming to us today from his home in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, Eric Pittman, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'm honored that you chose me to come on your podcast.
Well, after reading the story, I couldn't see how. I just couldn't resist. So to kick things off, Eric, your story begins in the skies and ends up eye to eye with hummingbirds. So how did a helicopter bush pilot end up behind the camera filming these little tiny birds in your backyard?
Well, it's kind of a long and twisted story, but at the core of it is I've discovered it was a lot safer to film things that are hovering than to be flying and hovering. And it starts back in the 80s when I was a helicopter bush pilot. So I was lucky enough to get hired by Western Helicopters in Buffalo Narrows, Saskatchewan for my first job. But the boss didn't really like me and he kind of hired me by default. So when I got there, he was really testing me. So he said, if you can build a helicopter out of the wrecked helicopters behind the hangar, you can stay on all summer. So I didn't have enough money to go home. I was literally stranded in Buffalo Narrows. So I got the books and I got the wrenches and I built a helicopter. And then I got to fly it all summer. As I traveled around as a helicopter pilot, I ended up in British Columbia doing helicopter logging. And I eventually made my way to Victoria. And I've been in Victoria now since about 1987. And there are resident hummingbirds here. So we started to get more resident hummingbirds here about the mid-90s. But they're kind of rare. But when my wife and I moved into this house that we live at now, we discovered that we had a lot of hummingbirds in the backyard. And it just became a fascination for me. I've always liked the idea of hummingbirds, and I would use them in my artwork previously when I was doing things that way. But to see hummingbirds and to film hummingbirds, it really took on a fascination for me.
And how did the documentary come about? And I'm curious, what was it, do you think, that resonates so deeply with people that it's so successful, 1.77 million viewers?
Yeah, it's a very successful documentary. A couple of things. One is that I've been doing this for so long that I've become an expert at it. And I don't say that lightly. I've spent way more than 10,000 hours filming hummingbirds. Because of that, I have a base knowledge of what the birds can do and how to expect them to show up on camera. A lot of the trick about filming hummingbirds is not finding hummingbirds, but it's getting the hummingbird in front of the camera. So you have to learn how to anticipate where the hummingbird's going to be. So that's one of the great things that I've been able to do over the years. So I've been able to find about, at this point, about 130 or 140 hummingbird nests. and film them from egg to completion. And through the years, as I put my hummingbird videos online at my Facebook site, Hummingbirds Up Close, people from different parts of the world began to chime in. And I got contacted by BBC or Netflix or CTV or different organizations that just wanted some hummingbirds in their shows. I got hired by BBC to go and film hummingbirds in Alaska and in Canmore, and various other groups would call me whenever they needed some assistance with this. The way that this documentary came about is that my neighbor does work for The Nature of Things. She's a filmmaker. So she works in the film industry in Canada. She makes documentaries, and she knows this wonderful cameraman, Ryan Wilkes, who was looking to do a film on hummingbirds. So she said to him, "You got to see Eric, because Eric films hummingbirds day in and day out, and he knows more about it than anybody else." So he showed up. We began filming together for about a year, and then he got funding for the film, and that was it. We just started making the film. Although there are a lot of my shots in the documentary, I really have to give a lot of credit to Ryan Wilkes, because he's a tremendous cinematographer. And without him and his vision, this film wouldn't go anywhere. It's because of him that it's struck such a chord among people.
And we'll certainly put a link to the video in the show notes. And of course, The Nature of Things is by the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Correct. Corporation. For those of you who may not be familiar with it. So 130, 140 hummingbird nests. I'm curious, out of all the things that you've come across, is there something, one or two things surprising that you've learned about these incredible birds that most people wouldn't expect?
Yeah, there's actually a lot. I'll try to keep it to one or two. The first thing is that they nest all year. I thought they'd only have one nest in the spring and that would be it. I've filmed hummingbirds and having nests in every month of the year except August. And I don't know why August. I've seen them hatch in the snow. I've seen them fledge on New Year's Eve, in fact. There's a whole lot of things about hummingbirds that we don't know as far as their reproductive cycles and times. And another amazing thing is that these little birds, right from the time that they hatch, they will literally stand on their heads to poop over the edge of the nest. These birds will not poop in their nest. So even on the day that the little chick hatches, I've got film footage of them standing on their heads to get their little butts high enough to poop over the edge of the nest. I know it's comical and it's funny, but that's actually what they do.
That's amazing. Now, Eric, you've worked with major names, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, National Geographic, BBC, Netflix. Can you think of one standout moment from filming or working with these teams that really sticks out for you?
In Alaska, I was up with the BBC in Juneau. I was hired to find a rufous hummingbird nest, which I did, but the bird never laid eggs, so we couldn't film that cycle of it. What we did instead was that we found a sapsucker tree. And if you know what a sapsucker tree looks like, it's got holes about every space about an inch apart in a grid pattern. And a sapsucker will come around and tap, drill a hole, and then when the sap begins to drain into the hole, it drinks the sap. So it sets these up around the forest. So it has a number of trees and it'll do its rounds from tree to tree. Well, we found this and we set up to film, and without fail, every 2 minutes, a hummingbird was behind it and it would come and eat out of the hole. I should explain a little bit deeper. The rufous hummingbirds travel from Mexico to Alaska, and they go to Alaska and the west coast of British Columbia to breed. So when they're up there, of course, they have to follow the weather. They can't precede the food supply. But when they get to Alaska, there's really not a lot of flowers blooming at that time of the year. So they rely upon things like the sapsuckers to open up the trees and get the sap flowing so that they're able to get some kind of food. And it was really amazing that you could do whatever you wanted in front of this bird within a couple of feet. It would not even acknowledge you. It was there to eat that sap. And the hummingbird would follow the sapsucker within 2 minutes. It was right behind it without fail, probably 30, 40 times a day.
Wow. I really have to see this.
Yeah, it was an incredible scene. There is a little clip from that that got put out as promotion. I'll see if I can find it.
That'd be great. So, Eric, you started with adventures in the air, the helicopters, the hummingbirds, and they continued underwater. Tell us a little bit about this underwater press conference. How did it come about? How did you pitch it? Just tell us about it.
Well, that was really a lot of fun. I wrote this book called Emails from a Nut, and the follow-up is All My Best. But I wanted some way to get a bit of a splash, to get some, you know, notoriety when you launch the book. And I looked in the Guinness World Book of Records, and I saw this record for the world's largest underwater press conference. And there was only 12 journalists that had gone under the water to do this press conference. And I thought, well, that's not a very big number. I wonder if I can do better than that. You know, there was a couple of problems involved. One was, you know, I didn't know how to scuba dive. And the other was I had to figure out what a journalist was. Throughout my research, and this is kind of funny, I checked out with Guinness World Records before I did it, how they would want me to do it and all that. You have to apply to break a record. You can't just break a record and then send it in. So I asked them, what's a journalist? And they told me, anybody that writes in a journal. Sounds okay. And then how far under the water do we have to be? Doesn't matter. You just have to be under the water. Okay. And what do I have to do under the water? Well, you have to have some kind of event that the people are attending so that it's an interesting event. Okay. So I wrote an underwater puppet show for the event, and I performed an underwater puppet show with the sound coming through the speakers that you would use for synchronized swimmers. It was a lot of fun. So it took me about 6 months to learn how to scuba dive. And in that process, I learned that all divers write in a journal. So I asked Guinness and they said, yep, it's a journal. They're journalists. Great. Now I've got a group of divers that I'm learning with. And the key to getting divers or people to participate in anything I found was if you offer free beer, a lot of people will show up. So in the 6 months that I learned how to scuba dive, I would visit different dive clubs around the areas, and I'd put up a little poster that said, hey, we're trying to do a Guinness World Record here. And, you know, by the way, come take part and you get free beer. On the day of the event, we had 61 divers show up. It was really amazing. And I had a whole event going on where I had a fellow who played King Neptune, and we sank the puppet stage down to the bottom of the ocean or to the bottom of the pool. And I performed a puppet show under the water for all the journalists sitting on the bottom of the pool. And it was hilarious. I had the best time. And it seems like everybody else did too. So it was really a lot of fun.
I'm assuming the beer came after the event, not before.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And there was a lot of licensing involved with that too. You know, I had to make sure nobody drank more than, I don't know what it was, 4 beer or something like that. And I had to take responsibility for all these 61 divers. So, you know, because liquor laws and serving beer and that kind of stuff. But it went quite well. Spinnaker's was a great sponsor of that event and everybody had a good time.
And did it help you sell your book?
No, not at all. But that didn't dissuade me. I made another book anyhow.
It sounds like you got a lot of mileage out of it one way or another.
Well, I just like doing these little adventures. If I don't have a project going on in a year, I get bored. So I just have to make something that's interesting to me so that I have fun in life. And that's really what I've tried to do.
What encourages you to keep taking on these little projects?
It's just so entertaining. Like who would have thought that an underwater puppet show would lead to, you know, a Guinness World Record and all this. And there's always some kind of unexpected consequence or event that comes out of doing these kind of crazy things. You just never know what's going to happen.
And you blew that record out of the water from 12 to 61. That's 5 times.
Yeah, it was hilarious. Yeah.
Well, since we're in the water, let's stay in the water and talk about the orcas. What inspired you and I guess Greg McElroy to co-found the Canadian Orca Rescue Society?
Right. So we started the Canadian Orca Rescue Society in a big effort to save the southern resident killer whales. There's only 73 of them, and they're a distinct subspecies that can only eat salmon or smaller fish. So when the Trans Mountain pipeline was under consideration for twinning, and the Trans Mountain pipeline is the way that Alberta gets oil to the ocean, so they can get it into tankers and send it away to the U.S. or to other parts of the world. What that meant to the orcas in the Salish Sea was that the tanker traffic would go up 400%, and that would increase the noise factor, which makes it a lot harder for them to find food. Because, of course, orcas find food using sound underneath the water, sort of like dolphins do as well. They don't use visual clues. They find it by the sound. And when you've got all this tanker traffic around, it makes it a lot harder to find the salmon. So when the Trans Mountain Pipeline got approved, Greg and I didn't want to just give up and go home and lick our wounds. We still want to improve things for the southern resident orcas. So we spoke to a lot of experts, and they said the best way to help the orcas is to bring back salmon to every river and creek in BC. So that's what we're focusing on. Restore the salmon habitat, get more salmon out there, and make life easier for the southern resident orcas.
And you created these life-size inflatables. How does that fit in?
Well, when we were going to protest the Trans Mountain Pipeline, we also know that the best image takes the front page. So we built 11 life-size inflatable orcas based on individuals in the southern resident pod. And when these are inflated and being carried above the heads of people in a protest, they kind of stand out. And, you know, people are amazed. You know, our largest one is 32 feet long. And at the time, we had them flying with helium. You know, they'd fly above the crowd. It was really amazing. So, of course, we got our pictures in a lot of places, and it started to bring more awareness to the plight of the orcas.
Mm, certainly a master of PR.
Well, it worked. And we go to so many events now in Victoria. These are not my words. These are other people's words. The orcas are now iconic in events, environmental events in Victoria.
Wow. What you do certainly requires a significant amount of communication and leadership skills. So I'm curious, Eric, when did Toastmasters first appear on your radar, and what made you join Thunderbird Toastmasters?
Well, I think the article said 2008, and I did it so that I could get better at public speaking. I end up in a lot of events and a lot of places where you have to talk to people. And in my day job, I talk to people all day long, and I can talk to a strata or a group of people about things without being nervous anymore. And, you know, I can do this as well. At the time, I just wanted to get better. You know, there's never any harm in improving yourself. That's why I joined Toastmasters, was to get better at public speaking. And it's really helped a lot.
Did you stumble across it, or did someone make a recommendation, or how'd you find it?
It was an old friend of mine that recommended it. She said that it changed her life, and I can believe it. She was the type of person that was kind of quiet, and she ended up going to Toastmasters, and she just found a whole circle of friends and support people, and it changed her life. It made it so that she was an immigrant, so she didn't speak English as well as a native speaking English person would. And it really increased her vocabulary and helped her get along in our culture a lot better than had she not taken it.
Now, of course, you left the fold for a little while and you rejoined, I understand, to prep for your interviews around the documentary.
Right.
Is there some specific skill or moment that helped you most in that process?
One of the main things that has helped me in Toastmasters is not using crutch words. I find that when I'm on film explaining something, if I'm using a crutch word, I'm really taking away from my message. And I see this with politicians and public figures a lot. They'll use so many crutch words that you start to count them. You go, he said, so many times that you lose the message and you start to focus on his stumbles. So those are the kind of things that really make the difference between a sort of amateurish production or a real polished production. How well are the ideas communicated? Is it clean, or do you have to listen to a lot of ums and ahs in between words?
Yes, that's the challenge with Toastmasters. Once you become a Toastmaster, you listen for those ahs and ums all the time.
Right.
How I got rid of mine, for the most part, was our club had a fine if you had five or more. So after giving up my paycheck on a weekly basis, no, just kidding, just a few cents here and there, it was an encouragement, or it was the carrot there. It was the beer, if you will.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You try to stop using them.
Yeah. Once you hear it, you can't unhear it.
Yeah, that's true.
The confidence that comes with knowing that you can speak in front of a group is important. you've got to be able to stand up in front of people and not stammer and not get nervous and not sweat. What do they say? Never let them see you sweat. Mm-hmm. Once you let a crowd see you sweat, you lose credibility. I've been in a lot of situations in my professional job where I'm selling windows, and you have to maintain composure when you're dealing with a crowd of 20 people in a strata, and you know that some of them don't like you or want to go with the other company, and they want to trip you up. So you have to be able to maintain your composure and explain yourself clearly and articulately and not sweat.
I had a nice little chuckle in the article. Of course, Megan interviewed one of your fellow Toastmasters, and Lynn Goodacre, and she had said that you had this passion for hummingbirds, yet the club teases you about trying to speak on other topics. So how's that working out?
Well, it's actually worked out quite well. I have done a lot of hummingbird talks there, but those are essential for what I'm doing right now. I'm trying to transition from being a window salesman to becoming a presenter of my videos. So I practice at Toastmasters by giving my speeches and talking along to the videos. It's helped a lot. However, when I talk about other things, I usually try to make it adventurous or exciting or humorous, because I like being entertaining when I'm talking. I don't want to just talk about everyday stuff that anybody can do. I've had an extraordinary life, I believe. So I like to show those stories. Some of them are very fun. And it's fun for me as well as for people that are listening.
Yeah, I'm sure anyone can fly a helicopter and anyone can do underwater press conferences. Just kidding. Folks, if you've been enlightened by Eric's journey and want to go out, save the world, or set a world record of your own, I encourage you to share this episode with your friends, family, and fellow Toastmasters. You can find the Toastmasters podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, toastmasters.org, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to check out Eric's story, from helicopters to hummingbirds, how one Toastmaster used his skills on camera, underwater, and beyond, in the August 2025 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Now, Eric, before we wrap up, I got one more question, and then we're going to ask you to let us know where people can find you. I am actually just curious. You seem to be a bounder for new adventures. What's next for Eric Pittman?
Well, I'm having a good ride with this film, and I just finished a TED talk about hummingbirds and compassion and conservation. So I'm hoping to expand on showing some of my footage as I narrate it on stage. That's my next little adventure here. I'm 65 now. I'd like to retire from selling windows, but I don't want to retire from everything. I'm looking to get myself, I guess, booked into different venues where I can talk to people about hummingbirds and do a little bit of conservation talk and just sort of make the world a little bit better to live in.
That's awesome. And of course, Toastmasters is a great place to help you make that happen.
I wouldn't be able to do it if I didn't take Toastmasters.
That's awesome. Eric, if someone is interested in reaching out and finding out more about what you do, or perhaps want you to film hummingbirds for them, what's the best place for people to reach you?
You can go to my website, hummingbirdsupclose.com. And that's my name on Facebook and on Instagram. It's all Hummingbirds Up Close.
Great. And we'll certainly put that information in the show notes. Eric Pittman, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. And it's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate that.